Welcome back to another episode of the Rugby Room on the Hollis Sports Podcast. Today I'm joined by Brad, and we're going to be talking about some of the bigger games coming up over the next few weeks. We'll be kind of talking about kind of maybe the progression around kind of the Leinster squad over the last couple of years. I know you have a lot of experience in terms of kind of rugby analysis, Brad. So how are you doing today?
Good. How are you, Kieran? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah, no problem at all. I'm always doing good. Anytime we can talk about Leinster rugby and rugby in general, it's always a good day.
Yeah, we can't really go to it or watch it, so we may as well talk about it.
Exactly. And one of the things that kind of reminded me of that was watching actually the Munster game at the weekend. It was like how terrible it was for a day like that in that stadium against Toulouse not to have fans in the stadium. It's one of those kind of things that we were talking off air. It's like, when is this lockdown gonna stop? Because that would have been the perfect situation for a packed house at Tolman Park.
Even for a fan, and even for the players, for someone like Entomac or DuPont to experience playing in Tolman would have been fantastic for them. But like for the 26,000 people to go and watch those two play would have been a huge benefit for look, it would have been great, and then the sun came out, which is a rarity in this country as well. So to play rugby like that, it was just brilliant. It's just so unfortunate the way it's panned out.
I know. I think that's the biggest thing that I think a lot of fans will take from it, is that so many people I think may have before took for granted. I know from myself going to like the majority of Leinster games throughout a year, that you kind of take for granted getting to go to the games all the time. And now you're like, I wish I could just go to any game. I remember one of my folks was talking about like a random football match, and they're like, oh, who would want to watch that? I'm like, honestly, if somebody gave me tickets to it, I'd go. but look, it's an interesting one. What I wanted to start off first is just in terms of kind of what you would do in terms of kind of the video work or the analysis in rugby, is how much work actually goes into that on a weekly basis for a team. That's even for yourself now in the AIL.
Yeah. Well, look, in terms of my journey as an analyst, I probably was at the very top. I don't do a whole lot of analysis now. I still do quite a bit. I've actually gone into more lecturing and academics and the research behind analysis and how that actually forms within sports, which has been great, because I'm not only dealing with rugby, I'm dealing with GA, basketball, hockey, swimming. We have a student who's an analyst for Swim Ireland, and that's been brilliant because I've actually learned so much from that part of it. But in terms of what an analyst in rugby is now doing, like, it's just exploded. It has absolutely exploded because technology's got better, software's got better, the squad sizes have got bigger, the need for analysis has got absolutely massive from coaching staffs. I think when I started off first, it was very much, who's your man? What do you mean? He's here to look at video. It was something that was not done, and we kind of struggled with it at the start. But I think now, being an analyst, I think I'm looking at teams now and they have four or five analysts within their teams, attached to their teams. Whereas 15 years ago, it was just me on my own, and that was the way it happened. And even like stuff like technology, like you're looking at four camera feeds going into a laptop, whereas we were lucky if we had one, you know. So so in terms of the progress that has actually happened, you can't even describe it. You can't describe the difference. And for use to people like Emmett Farrell in Leinster and George Murray in Munster, like, they've kept ahead of the game. They've been in it for 15 to 20 years, and they've kept going, and they're actually world-class analysts, you know. And it's great to see that their knowledge is kept, and knowledge works throughout the whole company, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I've been noticing that a lot, especially over lockdown and rugby, because look, I guess before, in terms of for fans, a lot of fans didn't really look too much into it because there was games so quickly after each other. You were looking at maybe a 4 or 5 day difference, and then suddenly there's another game. So where I kind of looked at this and draw kind of comparisons is when I kind of, I'd be quite a big NFL fan. And it's one of the biggest things that they have there, mainly from bringing players from college going into the professional game, because it's, you spend so much of your money and so much of your kind of your assets on some of these young players. And sometimes it's difficult to figure out how good someone can be. And they all, you always hear kind of general managers and scouts talk about the tape and how it depends on what we see on video, which in a lot of other sports, I think we're starting to see a lot now, but before we didn't. And like you said, it makes sense. And the fact that for yourself, when you were doing it, it was just you, and now there's bigger kind of four and five departments. We talk about, even in when you look at football, that you look at about 10 to 12 years ago and you wouldn't have heard any football club use analytics, and now it's like the key phrase all the time. So it is an interesting one. How important do you think that is in terms of, let's say, for a big game? Look, we'll be talking about the Champions Cup coming up at the weekend. How much time do you think is worth the players and the coaching staff going through the video from the previous week versus actually just getting out there, getting on the training pitch and kind of going through kind of your own kind of your own tactics for the week?
Yeah, I think it's very much based on the coach that you have. So if you've a coach who wants to spend an awful lot of time on the opposition, they're going to fly through a hell of a lot of clips, and they'll want everything. They want camera angles. I know, even talking to some of the Irish players since Paul O'Connell's come in, that's been a big part of what they do. And you can see Paul sitting in the stand with his head in the laptop and stuff like that. But and I think the depending on the coach and what they want, because I've worked with coaches that don't want to use analysis, that have no interest in it. They just want to park it, and it's very much they want to worry about their own team and what they do. I've seen coaches 80-20, so 80% on their own team, 20% on the opposition. And I've also seen coaches 50-50, where they split their times. But in terms of what the analyst will do the week of a Heineken Cup game, most of their work is probably done in the weeks leading up into it. So you'll probably go into greater detail for those big Heineken Cup games, and for those, like I would imagine, and again, I've no inside knowledge here on this. With the exception of one of the teams in the where I've seen some of their analysis, I would imagine they put a hell of a lot more work into these weeks as opposed to a different game against either Zebre or Ospreys or someone like that. So there's a lot more work goes into it, because the stakes are so high, and they're looking for that 1%. They're looking for that little thing that they can find. I think when you, one thing about the seven games on the weekend, last weekend, was the amount of analysis that went into it, because you can see the set piece tries, you can see what they were trying to do, you can see what the game plans were and how they were actually developing their strategies around. They were basing it on what they had seen before. So I think the modern coach, I think the more up-to-date coach, I'm going to say the younger coach, so the ones that are not as old, are because they've grown up with it. They've grown up when they started coaching in 35, 40, this is now what they're used to, and they've got better at it. And in fairness, the analysts now are so much better than what they were in the past.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Again, I kind of go towards I think it was in the Munster game, I remember kind of there was a line out, I think it was in Munster's own 22, and they stole it. And the one thing that was mentioned was all the video work just to get that kind of one steal from a line out. And I think we do take it for granted when watching just how much work does go in there, because just for one piece of play, and the fact that a play like that was stolen, that could be one of the main reasons you've prevented a try from the opposition. So it makes sense why the analysis is becoming such an important kind of part of a team's kind of, I guess, their game plan for the week. Because we always hear, in terms of for a lot of the sports that do have a lot of kind of tactical analysis, that there are days that it's pretty much for looking at the tape on the opposition, seeing what they do well, and then being able to put in a plan into place. But I think what you said is really important, is it can depend on the coach. And do you think that it's important that it's not someone that's too reliant on it, and that there should be a balance between both using, kind of, as we said, the technology that's there, that's available for you, but also knowing that, well, you also still need to do what makes you best and not just trying stopping what the opposition is doing, that you need to be able to play your own game plan as well.
Yeah, look, I know it's been mentioned over the last 12 months on social media that, oh, coaches have their heads in laptops and it's about looking up on the field, and we have all this kind of vibe going on, and I'm just kind of chuckling at myself, because I think if you blur the players' heads with information, you're not going to get a happy product on the field. Like, if a player is running onto that past the white line and they're worried about, well, this player scratches his bum if he's going to get it, or he scratches his nose, or if I hear the color red, this is where I'm going to do. And I think that's what a good coach does. He takes the cloud away, and look, it's only there to help. It's not there to give you all the answers. And I think the good coaches use it as an aid, as opposed to using it to give them solutions. And I think you've got to be really careful on it. But I do look back at Ireland's line-out defence in the Six Nations was absolutely sensational. And I think it was down to the work they put in off the field, as opposed to the work they did in match day, because they had every single of the opposition's line-outs completely and utterly, overanalyzed. No, they had it actually the right amount, because it received they got rewards for the work they put in. And that to me just shows how good it was, you know. And I've seen so many different examples of this happen, whether it be in World Cups, European Cups, Six Nations, where the good coaches are putting in the yards, they're putting in the work, because that's part of the game. That's part of what being professional is about. And I kind of chuckle at the coaches that just don't believe in this, and they just, oh no, it's head and laptops. No, where I'm an on-field coach. Well, I guess what, you're getting a tool that's actually going to make you 20% better. Do you not want it? So I think it's here to stay. I actually think we're only at the tip of the iceberg. I think this is going to keep exploding. You know, the level of interest is not only in rugby, in rugby in Ireland, in all sports in Ireland. Like, the GAA have, like, I set up a master's course in sports performance analysis in the Institute of Technology in Carlo. And we are inundated with people who want to do it. We are inundated with people who are working in industry that want a professional qualification. We're inundated with people who have finished either a sports science degree and they want to get involved in this. And we've shaped our course. We've had to shape our course. We've had to redesign modules to match the technology. We've introduced modules in data analytics, because that's now quite a big area. We're now doing OR and Tableau and all these sort of business analytic tools and using their software. Why? Because sport is now demanding that this is where you're going. And we're only just seeing the beginning of it, definitely.
Yeah, I completely agree. It was always one of the things, because being a fan of a lot of the American sports, they've used it for quite a while now, especially when I kind of look at the likes of basketball and I look at the NFL. They've used it for the past, I'd say, 10 to 15 years. Yeah. And all you've seen is the departments kind of grow and grow and grow to where it's become one of the mainstays of an organization now. And we're starting to see that, like we said, in rugby. And I think the example of using the Irish line-out is perfect, because it was one of the talking points going into the Six Nations, because it was such a weak point in the previous Six Nations and in the Autumn Nations that we weren't getting a lot from the line-out. And I guess one of the keys that I take from it, and that it probably worked quite a lot, is that that's a very young Irish pack, and it's probably one that's very conducive to using a lot of this kind of new analysis, new technology that really, and like you said, you can see it works in the fact that you brought Paul O'Connell in, who believes in it. And when you have a coach that truly believes in it, I think that's when you get the players believing. If you have a coach that is being told that they have to use this, it's difficult for them, the players, to go in and buy in. And you see that all throughout sports, that the clubs that really do believe in kind of looking at the video and analyzing kind of what's gone on in previous weeks, that they're the ones that you can kind of see they use it to their advantage, not just use it because they're being told to use it.
Yeah. No, definitely. And we've seen, like, I jokingly tell my class that we're only here now because of Moneyball, because of the movie.
Yeah.
Because of Brad Pitt. And as I joke to my class, when you tell people what you do, you tell them, by the way, you're not the Brad Pitt character, you're the other character. So
yeah,
it shocks a few people. No, it is. And that movie made it, as soon as you make a Hollywood movie about analytics, that this is what people want to jump into. And, you know, but I'm firmly, I tell all my students the same, it's not going to give you the answers. It will aid, but it's not going to give you. Like, I'm involved with the Leinster 18s. I'm assistant coach there, and we only had a meeting 2 weeks ago about how we would use data and what does data look like outside of the professional game. And I would never have thought we'd have a conversation like that 10 years ago. Never. Yeah. And it just shows where we actually are, and it's a very healthy conversation. How can data help us? How can it help our talent ID? How does it help us with selection? How does it help us with our training? How does it help us with our performance on the field? Is there anything we can gain from this? And I'm having conversations with five or six different people that are on the pathway as well. And it's, I kind of finished the calls going, this is brilliant. This is where we are actually going. And I think it's a good thing, because I've been over to clubs in the UK quite a bit, and soccer clubs, and I can see how powerful they use it. Like, we've actually, a group of us in two of the Leinster coach development officers and myself went over to Chelsea one day, and it's just amazing to see how data actually influences their academy system and how they actually operate. And it's one that we are modernizing to it, and it's where we're heading, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because I notice it now, because before I've always kind of been interested in some of the different kind of statistics that you get out of a game. And before, in rugby, when even you just look at it maybe 4 or 5 years ago after a Six Nations game, you get your normal kind of possession and territory, but you don't get like kind of some of the advanced statistics. And now when you look at some of the stuff that's coming out, you're actually getting that. And it's the first time in a while that you're seeing that. You see it in football as well. I know in soccer, they're using kind of like expected goals and like expected assists, and based on kind of what goes on. And it is an interesting one, because you mentioned Moneyball, and the one thing that I always try and say is that baseball is probably the perfect sport to basically focus on what you want to do on analytics, because it's all about numbers. And yeah, like, it's one of those sports that it's probably the only sport that you can fail 7 out of 10 times and still be an amazing player. So yeah, like, it's very interesting, and it goes to the point of where I think it is important that you're able to use the analytics, but it's also to be able to use them to your benefit and not overuse them. Because I always say, in terms of for performance, where you get players kind of peak levels is when they're going out there and they're not thinking, that they are reacting and they're playing so that they know what they're supposed to be doing. And like, we talk about rugby, like knowing the different plays, knowing kind of what to expect. Like you mentioned before, if someone mentions red, it's going to this player. That it becomes ingrained that they know what it is, instead of when you're out there having to think, because that's when I think you start getting players that play a little bit slower. Yeah. So I guess when players do grow up using analytics, and let's say we start using more of it in kind of the junior and senior cup rugby in Ireland, and if the players are constantly used to that growing up, it means once they do go into the academy system or go into the AIL and then go into kind of their professional career, that it just becomes part of their routine, and it makes it easier for them to play.
Yeah, Kieran, it has to be part of their education. It has to be, because we can't get to the stage where the player is fearful of performance and fearful of or always wanting to get those numbers. Oh, you think a good ball carrier or back row is carrying 15 times. I want to get to 15. And he's spurned a 6-on-1 overlap, and you're going,
yeah,
that's not where you do it. So it has to be, the players have to be educated as well as coaches into how the quality of this can help. And And that for me, even when it started off first, you did have a fear factor with players where they were constantly like nearly avoiding themselves getting into a tackle situation because analysis when it started was very negative marking, very much, you know, we measured tackles missed, we measured penalties conceded, and it was used to beat up coaches, or yeah. sorry, to beat up in players. I was working with Scotland in the Six Nations in a good while ago, and the company who was employed to supply the data would give it out to journalists before the press conferences, and you're going, this is like taken so out of context. A, is it accurate? And we did a study on how accurate it was. It was miles off what they were, but they were then able to question the coach about why did you miss 25 tackles here and why did you miss this. So it can't be used as a tool to beat up coaches on it. And I even see some of the media go into this as well. They look at whether it was a turnover on the line out, and they look for those negative figures. You know, like the Irish offload is a great example. At the end, I think, of round two or three, they were able to, the Six Nations had the offload charts and Ireland were at the bottom. And you're kind of going, well, hold on a minute. Two of these teams have already played the Italians, who were the worst team in the competition, unfortunately, where they were able to massive amount of offloads. And then when Ireland played Italy, it was all leveled out at the end. So it has to be taken in context, but we have to educate and get people to understand it. And if that means educating the media, and some of them are excellent at it, and there's tons and tons of journalists out there that are very much into their analytics and their analysis work and their opposition analysis and stuff like that. But we just need, when you start something like this, you can't let it run away from you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess one of the things that I would think of is, you were mentioning for the under-18s, for Leinster, do you notice that there's some of the players that coming from kind of schools rugby into the under-18s, even for the time in the summer, that you see some of these players get overwhelmed by some of the analysis that they have to go through? Or do you think that a lot of the players nowadays are actually becoming so used to it? Because we do see it at the kind of, especially at the senior rugby within the schools, that it's such a big part that you'll see them, they'll do their kind of training on the pitch, they'll do their gym work, but also they do have a lot of meetings during the week about kind of the video analysis.
Yeah, look, they're definitely a much more comfortable, the player nowadays is more comfortable in an environment where either a classroom environment where they're sitting down looking at it. What I think has really come on in the last 10 years, I think, is their ability to spot things in the analysis, because all these kids they've iPads, they've Sky Sports, they watch Super Rugby, they watch French rugby, they watch rugby all the time. And and we love creating an environment that they are actually the analyst, where they can actually start looking at things. And we might just go, well, what do you see here? What do you think? What can be better here? And you'll be amazed. They actually have the answers. They know it. At that level, those players, like I jokingly say, some of those players are 3 years off playing Heineken Cup. That's where they are. You know, yeah. But they definitely, over the last 10 years, the player that comes into our system is far better at using iPads and technology and software, and then they also add on the layers of being able to spot when things are correct and things are good and recognize opportunities. And that's a credit to where they're coming from. It's a credit to the systems and the environments in which they arrive from.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really interesting one. And look, I think it's being able to kind of talk about this, is it's important that we do notice that while it's important that there is kind of the two sides of it, and we mentioned it earlier before, is that balance between the two. Yeah. Unfortunately, we didn't have a game to kind of go through today, because that's what the initial plan was going to be, that we're going to be talking about the Toulon and Leinster game. I guess before we kind of move on to kind of some of the other games that did take place, what did you think about the whole kind of scenario there? I was talking to one of a French journalist earlier on today, and they were saying how annoyed Toulon were, considering they had the positive case on, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday, and they reported it to the European Rugby, and then they said to travel on Thursday, and then when they arrived at Dublin, they said that the game wasn't going to go ahead, and then they had to go back again. And when they tested again, I think it was on Thursday night or Friday morning, they all came back negative. So it was a really interesting one. I think it was probably the right call, because you do want to try and protect all of the players. What do you think of the kind of COVID kind of rules that they've put in place? Because I know earlier on in the competition, it was a bit unfortunate that there were some teams that were getting knocked out because they had a COVID case, when there were weeks in between that you possibly could have played the games, similarly to how we played the France and Scotland game.
Yeah.
The game that we just saw there obviously couldn't have gone ahead because the quarterfinals are this weekend anyway. But yeah. How do you think they've dealt with kind of the COVID cases that have happened this year?
Yeah, look, I definitely know Leinster don't want to go to a quarterfinal of a Heineken Cup on a walkover. No one does. And someone will be lying to tell you that. However, I'd say Leo is quite happy to get the week off, and for his players to have a week off is great, especially at this junction where a good chunk of his players have already played in the Six Nations. So to recharge the batteries, I don't know where they are in terms of other injuries. Maybe one or two might come back for the extra game. So I think that's a plus in terms of, look, we probably don't have the real story. We don't have the complete story. We're getting what I read in the papers. I do know there's three independent medical people who looked into the case, and they just decided that the risk was too great, and they've got to think about the risk to the other team, you know, whatever about you containing that risk within one team, but to move it into two teams and then beyond, you're in all sorts of trouble, like of where we're going to go. So if that game had taken place and Leinster won and Leinster then had a case, how does that judge the Leinster extra game down the line? And then if Leinster win again or if Exeter win again, how does that go to the semi-final level? So there's a lot of other things that they need to consider. Yeah, the story that's in the newspaper, it's really hard look on Toulon. It is tough on them, and but no one wants to see that. And the competition doesn't need to see that. And that's just unfortunate with the situation we're in at the moment, that we can't take risks. You know, so I think that's important. It's interesting. Toulon, I think, had the exact same situation happen pre-Christmas, where
playing
Scarlets, and they refused to play because Scarlets had a case. So you can see there's a bit of irony in that as well. So I know they're jumping up and down on it. I'm going to say rightly so. No, I don't know whether it's rightly so. I think the competition made the correct decision because they've got to think of the other teams in the competition. Look, the whole COVID situation, as I jokingly say to my wife, I've got two daughters, and we as a parent during COVID, there's no book on this.
Yeah,
no, we can't flick the page to page 78, and it's exactly the same for rugby administrators. They can't. This is all new. This is new for everyone, and people are going to make bad decisions, similar to governments and sports administrators, but they're doing what's right at this moment in time. And have they done what's right for this moment in time? I think so. I think they have.
Yeah,
but look, it's benefit the team I support. So
yeah, it's an interesting one, because I was having this conversation over the weekend with some of my friends about Leinster getting straight through. And my question was, would it be an advantage or disadvantage? And I have kind of two kind of theories of thinking. Is the advantage side would be, obviously, you might get one or two players back. And there would have been other players that would have got a few niggles as well after the Munster game as well, the previous weekend. Then I guess the other thing is, you've just had Exeter playing in a high pressure game in the round of 16, that all those players have come back, and Leinster would then be 2 weeks without playing a game. Do you think that there's more in it, that getting some of your players back, giving players the extra week to kind of go on this? You probably know early on that you're playing against Exeter, so you can kind of get a bit of a run in at them. Or do you think the fact that Exeter got to play this week and then just go straight away and playing the following week, which one do you think is a more advantageous position to be in?
can I answer at 9 a.m. or 9 p.m. on next Saturday?
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, Ciarán, there's no real, those players are battle hardened. They're already battle hardened. And that's one thing you try and do with your players. You battle harden them through matches, through training. And that's where they are. I actually think it might work out to Leinster's favor. Fingers crossed, because I think that rest mentally and physically is huge at this stage of the season. If it had happened where Leinster came off a back where they didn't play a Pro 14 final, where they had everyone together and they didn't play as a group since January time or the last round of Heineken Cup games, I would say yes, it's a problem. It's going to be a problem. But they've had that game together as a group. Look, who can tell? It's some weeks it works, some weeks it doesn't work. But I actually think at this stage of the season, a rest is a good thing.
Yeah, I tend to agree, considering you do look at some of the injuries now. I know there'll be many of them that probably still won't get back, but you would have had the likes of James Ryan, Gary Ringrose come closer. Now, they probably won't make the game, but I think the bigger situation is Ross Byrne and Johnny Sexton, who both were planned on missing the game in terms of being fully fit. So I think that's probably a big thing. And then also some of the younger players that you were going to be playing, you get them that extra week.
Yeah.
Kind of going in with the side, you look at the likes of kind of Ryan Baird, who's had a very good couple of weeks anyway, getting to play for Ireland and then getting to play in some of these big games as well. Yeah. I think the one thing that I think everybody can agree with, and I hope that they have some sort of plan, is that once we get past the quarterfinal stages, that there is some sort of plan for the semifinals, because the last thing you want is a COVID case and a team gets through to a final without having to play in the semi-final. I think that's where there probably needs to be some sort of different scenario rather than what we've seen so far in the Champions Cup, where it's 28-0 and the team just goes straight through, because then I guess you kind of go on it. We want to see the two best teams play in the final. Hopefully at this point that it'll happen. I think the one thing that probably worries a lot of fans is we've seen that the bubbles that have happened in France haven't been as strong as other countries.
Yeah.
I was even reading some of the stats, even in football, for example, today, where they mentioned that there was one positive test in something like 500 or 600 in the Premier League. But yet we're seeing these quite regularly in the top 14. We've seen it with the France national team. We've now seen it with Toulon. With five French teams still in it, do you think that it actually is a really important thing that the Champions Cup do have to kind of consider? We need to have kind of a backup plan just in case something like this happens in the semi-final.
I would be very surprised if they don't have a backup plan already. They probably just haven't made it public yet. But yeah, I agree with you. I think there has to be a backup plan for this. But I'm kind of, fingers crossed, we got 14 games in the Six Nations with absolutely zero disruptions, and we were traveling to Italy, France, and obviously the UK and Ireland, so that was spread around six countries, so that's been a huge plus. I do realize there's five teams now in the quarterfinals in France. France have entered a lockdown, as far as I know, last Saturday.
Yeah,
they've always had a curfew. Even during the Six Nations Paris games, their curfew was 8 p.m., where everyone had to be off the streets. So look, who can tell? Like we're in a situation where this virus, it's not out of hand at the moment, but it can very easily get away from us all. And look, hopefully we get this done. Hopefully we can get these games played. Yeah, throwing it back to the rugby administrators, I would not like to be in their shoes if there is a case in the semi-final. I just wouldn't like it. I even don't like what they were in at the weekend with Toulon, and having to do that to Toulon was not an easy decision for those guys.
Yeah, it's really difficult, and I guess that's the hard thing about when you do have to have the quarterfinal pretty much the next week after the round of 16, because if anything bad happens, well then that's it. And look, it could have been worse if they played the game and then let's say Leinster got it, and then you've two teams let's say if it wasn't diet, if they weren't able to find out the test results didn't come back as positive and they played the quarterfinal and then suddenly one of the next test results come back positive, and then that's where it can, as you said, it can probably get away from us.
Yeah.
In terms of for the matchup against Exeter, look, we've seen how good they've been recently, and look, they're champions for a reason. You saw Leon come out really fast against them, and it actually looked like it was going to be a really, really tough game because you saw Leon score, I think it was two really quick tries, but then they were able to kind of come back into it. I guess the one question is, in terms of for Leinster, the last kind of 2 to 3 seasons, they've been relatively unscathed in the Pro 14. And what was it, last year they went pretty much the whole season unbeaten. They only lost 2 games this season. Do you think that they progressed? Because the one question that I think a lot of people have is when it comes to that big game in the Champions Cup, they've fallen short. We've seen it with the Saracens over the last 2 seasons. Prior to that, you saw it with some of the top French teams when they'd come up against them, that they just fall a little bit short. Do you think that Leinster have learned enough over the past year from some of the mistakes that they made, especially against the Saracens, where you expected this big performance from a Leinster team and they just look second best?
Yeah, look, Kieran, I think it's a great question because, like, look, I'm a Leinster supporter. Like, I actually very rarely look at them in terms of analysis and go through that. And but, like, I'm a fan, really. So when I watch Leinster, I watch it with a beer in my hand. I don't watch it with the laptop on,
as it should be.
And I've probably subconsciously, because I've worked with the team years and years ago, that's probably the way I've always looked at things. You'll notice I don't stick anything up on social media on Leinster. Why? Because I actually don't look at them in that great detail.
Yeah.
I think Leinster can play whatever way they want to play. I think if they want to play tight, they can play tight. I think if they want to expand and play fast, they can play fast. I think if you look at, they can probably match the likes of Exeter when they get into the opposition's 22. They're definitely as efficient, if not better, when they get in there. I know it's a huge strength of Exeter, but I would definitely say they'd rival any team in the competition there. In terms of the losses against Saracens, they lost a final in Newcastle, I think it was. Yeah, Newcastle.
Yeah.
To be honest, that kind of game could have gone anywhere. Like I can remember moments in the game where they had an overlap and one of the players didn't give it and it was a certain try. I can remember we didn't kick out when we should have kicked out, and it kind of stemmed on a flick of a coin all the way through. And I'd like to think they have learned from that, and the likes of Leo would have helped them through that. Look, no one likes to lose a final. We don't. They don't prepare themselves to lose a game. They prepare themselves to win. The Saracens game in Lansdowne Road or the Aviva was probably pretty grim. But I actually think it was a top 6 inches loss. I think because it wasn't the Saracens team they played 12 months ago, there was a lot of changes in that Saracens team. I just wonder whether they didn't take it as serious. I don't mean that serious. Probably that's the wrong word. Did they take their eye off the ball? Were they concentrating on the next match? Because when they found themselves 23-3 or 21-3 down, they actually started to play. And when they started to play and increase the pace of the game, they got into it. They scored 2 good tries. They got themselves back into the game. And then, unfortunately, the clock beat them in the end.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important, even this weekend, that they find the right game plan. And I'm even going to go back 2 weeks because I think they found the right game plan to play Munster. I think we can probably say the last 2 or 3 times they played Munster, they got into a bit of an arm wrestle. You probably could have thrown the ball away for a good part of 30 minutes in those games. And it became a bit of a struggle. Now, you know, we had that game of the hundreds of box kicks, and it was just like, what are we doing here? You know, if we actually move these guys around, you can play a bit. And I thought they did that in the final of the Pro 14. I would love Leinster to do that to Exeter at the weekend. I think when you look at the first 2 tries they scored, they scored out towards the edge where they actually stretched them a bit down the 13 channel. Even the last try, I know it was in the last minute, they moved them around a bit. And because I'm not too sure this Exeter team can play fast, even though they have the likes of Hogg in the team and stuff like that. But that's the game I would love to see them play. However, if they feel they have to beat them up for 65 minutes, Leinster can do that and they will go there. Things they have to watch out for: they have to deny Exeter field position, because those guys inside your 22, whether it be a line-out maul, whether it be their pick-and-go game, are excellent. They are absolutely, like, they're the European champions. They're in their own backyard. Yes, it's a closed stadium. There's no fans there to holler them on. But I would just love to see Leinster move them around and play really fast and play quick and back themselves a bit. I wouldn't like to see an arm wrestle going on. Leinster are a team of internationals. Exeter have half their team are internationals. Like, there's no reason why they can't go there and win. You know, and we're now in the last eight. Like, we watch the games of the weekend. There's incredible teams still in the competition. Like, it's actually scary. I looked at what Racing did to Edinburgh. It was actually scary to watch. You know, and this is where we're at. We're at the business end. So there's no gimmies now, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because you look at actually all the teams that are left in it, and you look at any single one, and it's a really tough game. And you can mix any of these two teams, put them in the final, and I don't think you'd have a bad game. And that's one of the, which is actually very surprising considering everything that's gone on with COVID this year, that people weren't sure would we get the best teams going in, especially. I guess the only kind of outlier is you look at Sale, who got into the round of 16 without winning a game, but then destroy the Scarlets, and people are like, well, that was definitely not expected. So it is an interesting one. What I find is very interesting is the fact that there are five French teams for the first time in the quarterfinal, and it kind of goes to what we saw in the Six Nations, is that the French sides are getting very, very strong, and it's going to be very hard for some of these teams to go on and beat them. So I think I think the Exeter and Leinster game is the perfect game. I think everybody wanted to see it eventually, because after what Exeter did last year, you look at how strong Leinster have been, and they've shown, I agree with you, what they showed against Munster in that final, while they weren't as clinical as they normally are.
Yeah,
they made Munster play the way Leinster wanted to play that game.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing that they need to do with Exeter. They need to kind of make Exeter have to play more, have to play rugby instead of like make it more expansive, make it so that they do make mistakes. And because we saw when Leon played really expansive rugby early on against them, Exeter looked like they were in a lot of trouble. But then once they kind of got a foothold into the game and were able to kind of push the kind of game plan they wanted to play, it was difficult for Leon to kind of match that kind of physicality that Exeter were bringing them. So
yeah, it's interesting. Exeter have lost two games at home this year. This calendar year. So they lost to Gloucester a few weeks ago, which was more or less a second team. It looked like a resting team when you look through the team sheet. But the game that I think is interesting is the Bristol game. So Bristol can play this really fast. They can play like a super rugby team at times.
Yeah.
Even they showed glimpses of it at the weekend. They came up short. But they move teams around. They're pretty expansive. They're top of the Gallagher Premiership. They've got a fantastic coach. And I think I would like Leinster to go down that avenue to try and play against Exeter. But they can play any way they want. They have the players that can play like that. They've got, obviously, the front row they will deal with that Exeter front row. Like, I can't see a penalty try going like Leon give away a penalty try at the weekend at scrum time. I'm probably speaking in hope, and you know, hopefully they'll come through it, you know. But look, it's going to be a great game.
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to, after the Munster and Leinster game, I had a podcast. We had one of the lads from the Leinster side and one from the Munster side, and one of the biggest differences I think we kind of came out with was that kind of front three from Leinster, and how they do set kind of the precedent for how the team is able to play, because it gives those backs a pretty good platform. And what I always kind of took from it is, because I know there was a lot of talk around James Lowe for Ireland, and how people kind of, some people thought that he shouldn't have played so early, and then others thought that it wasn't great kind of dropping them the way it did. But I think you have to compare the way Leinster play to the way Ireland plays. And with Leinster, I think he really does suit that style, where Leinster do like to have that strong platform, and it gives them that much more space, which I don't think we saw with Ireland, where it was more kind of forcing him to be kind of like the second kind of kicker in the team. And it, that doesn't really suit it. And unfortunately, I think the only reason they did that was the fact that he's left-footed, and Ireland didn't have another left-footer on the team.
I've made some minor season ticket holders in Leinster getting text messages going, who knew that Lowe could kick a ball? Like, he doesn't do that in Leinster. And, you know, like you're bringing a Rolls Royce engine. You got to play him like it. You can't play him as the second kicker, you know. But yeah, I just thought it was strange how their use of him. But
I thought it was the use, and also for a player that you've just brought into an international setup. And look, I think they need to treat it as if you were bringing in one of these young kids in there, because the first time they're playing international rugby. So regardless of how much Super Rugby he played previously or how much he played for Leinster, it is important that he would have been treated in the same way. And I feel like what happened was he was brought in straight after an injury where he hadn't played for months. And then when he's had a poor game, that he's just completely dropped out of the squad. And it can be difficult. And probably the best thing for him is that he gets to play in one of these kind of big games for Leinster, where they do play to his strengths. And you see it that he's out there and he's kind of one of those big motors going forward and allowing Leinster to play that expansive rugby. I feel like it kind of goes back to what we spoke about at the start. He's one of those players that when you see him for Leinster, he doesn't look like he's thinking. He's just playing. And for Ireland, I think one of the things you saw him do is I think he was thinking too much when he was playing kind of what he has to do next instead of just playing his game. And
I think he probably needs to remember what he was selected for. So he's selected on the back of what he does with his pro team. And if that performances that he puts in for Leinster is good enough to see him on an Ireland, why would you do something completely different? But like, look, we don't know whether he was told that we're playing a very strong kicking game, field position's important, we're not going down that. I would have loved to see James Lowe run at people and use his feet and use those offload skills. And I'm sure everyone I know, we've probably talked to death about it, everyone, like that's the James Lowe I want to see. And it didn't happen. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. And the opportunities like that didn't come about. And instead, we're talking about defense situations of him missing a few tackles. You know, might have been a system error more than him. But look, he's got to make some of those tackles that he makes. And he definitely would be the first man to stick his hand up and say, look, I made a mistake there. You know, so as I always say, I think it's really difficult, like, because the international game is so different and it is so difficult. And I think because the spotlight's on it, no player goes out there to actually say, well, watch me miss this tackle.
Yeah.
They're going out there to try their balls off. And I think we tend to, I said we probably turn a bit more like Premiership soccer at the moment, where the slightest mistake, like I look at Solskjaer and United.
Yeah. You know,
like again, last night at halftime, everyone's like, oh, Solskjaer out.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on, like he's second in the league. It's their highest ever finish, you know, that they've had in the over the last number of years. And we're still Solskjaer out. And you're going, sports are different. And for people who are involved in sport, everyone knows it's different.
Yeah, it is. It's because I think it kind of has come to the rise of social media that everything is so reactionary to a split-second decision that happens on a pitch, especially at international level in terms of rugby, because people expect that, well, every player should make the right decision every single time, but it doesn't work that way. Like you saw even against England, the exact same scenario that people were criticizing James Lowe for. We saw the same thing happened with Jacob Stockdale on the wing,
yeah,
where he didn't go for a tackle and he went for an intercept instead. But we don't hear it because the team ended up winning the game. Yeah. And that's the problem, is when you lose, all these moments get heightened and people want to, as we talked about the analysis, they want to overanalyze every little detail, when sometimes you have to kind of look at the context of kind of what was happening at the time. Like you said, someone making a missed tackle, well, is it just that? Is it a one-on-one individual error that they made? Or was there a system problem? Or did the opposition just make a better play than him? And I think that's the thing that people forget, is that these players aren't robots. They're not like PlayStation games that they can make mistakes. And that, I think that's the one thing that we kind of have to kind of look at times, is that the context behind it is actually really important. One of the things I kind of wanted to kind of touch on before kind of we end is, in terms of, because I had this conversation last week in terms of when I was talking about kind of Leinster and Munster, we were talking about kind of the gap between the two sides and how we're seeing so many of these young players come through Leinster getting into the international setup. Like, the one person I always kind of look at in recent years, which was a surprise, was actually with Ronan Kelleher, who, you look at a couple of years ago, he wasn't playing too much for Leinster, takes his opportunity with Leinster, gets drafted into the Irish setup, and now is a full-fledged international, starting all the big games for Leinster. But yet you're not seeing so much of this happen with Munster. You're seeing the odd player kind of come in and do well. So I guess, do you see a big difference in kind of the way it's worked within the Leinster Academy versus kind of what's happened in the Munster Academy? Or is there a different kind of culture in the two, that Leinster are really big on making sure we are bringing players in that at the end of the day get brought in into the squad? Because you look at the team that just won the Pro 14 and they've used 53 players. That's not something that you'll see a lot of teams do. Is that just ingrained within the culture in Leinster, or is there something that some of the other provinces can kind of take from what Leinster have done successfully over the last couple of years?
Yeah, look, we've probably heard this debate over the years. For years and years, we've heard this debate, you know, and I term it as a bit like a roller coaster. Everything's up and down. I think Leo Cullen's first season in charge, I think they lost 6 Heineken Cup games.
Yeah.
You know, they lost all pool games. So, and now they're winning all their pool games, and now they're talked about as being the top team in Europe. And that's the way it's actually happened. Look, I don't know what goes on in the inner circle of Munster's academy. I know they've changed their academy manager, or they're in the process of changing their academy manager. So for whatever reason, if they made the decision or whether that person moved on, but obviously there might have been some sort of issue there. But all I can say, look, I've coached at the schoolboy level in Ireland for best part of 20 years on and off. And I coached in Clongowes-Wood College for 9 years. I coached the senior team there mostly with Noel Mack, and who's now the academy manager of Leinster. And when we get the fixture list every year, you'd look down and go, well, are we going to Cork twice? Or are we going to Cork once? Are we going to Belfast once, or are we going twice? So basically, to the listeners out there, they have Prez Cork and Christians, and they're fantastic teams. And I know when Michaels go down there, when Blackrock go down there, when Belvedere go down there, it's always a tough game, and there's very little in it. There is very, very little. Rockwell or another big school as well. So the argument coming back towards Leinster is, oh, they've got all the big schools. I'm kind of going, well, hold on a minute. They're really, really competitive up to that under 19 age group. There's actually no difference. I've gone down there with a red hot Clongowes side and have got eaten, have got absolutely destroyed. And I know Andy and the guys in Black Rock have been the same, and they're tough, tough fixtures. You know, Rockwell are the same. You go down to Crescent, Ardskull in Limerick. They are tough, tough fixtures. And also involved in the age grade program, so the Leinster 18 schools. I was the analyst there for 12 years, and now I'm the assistant coach for the last 3. Any game we would have in Munster, So Munster, like for like, 18s or 19s, they'll win 1 year, we'll win the next year. They'll win 1 year. There's always a score in it. There might have been someone got red carded and one team won by 10. You know, this sort of stuff. So there's actually, for me, and this is, I'm looking at this from the chief seats. That's not actually the problem. For me, it's not the problem. But then you're talking about the players coming through. I think there's a good crop of young Munster players coming through now, which probably didn't happen before. I think what Leinster do really, really well is the club game. And I think the programs they have put in place over the last 10 years, whether it be regional sides, they're putting in coaches, coaching structures, putting in their weights. Like I lecture in the IT in Carlow. That's a training base for Leinster's age grade program for the kids who are living in the southeast. And they come in, they have do their two weights and two skill sessions a week. So they're nearly doing the same as what the schoolboy player will do. So that avenue and that's a plan. That's Leinster come up with a plan that this is what we need. We need to find the next Sean O'Brien. And people who have been through that gym, I've actually been Joey Carberry and Tom Daly, and who's now in Connacht. I can name off maybe 10 or 12 players who've all come through that system. So that's a huge avenue. And I don't know, someone can correct me, I'm not too sure that goes on in Munster, you know, but I probably shine the light on what happens when they leave school into the next level. You know, Leinster, they're stepping is under 20s rugby into sub academy, into academy, and then obviously into senior team, academy train with the senior team. I don't know whether that's the same in Munster. So that's something that someone in Munster can confirm or deny or what's going on. But that seems to be the problem. I listened to the RTE rugby podcast and Don Lennon, who's fantastic. Rugby administrator now down in Cork with Cork Conn. I think he's the president down there. He spoke about that their under 20s in Conn, and Conn are one of the number one clubs in the country, had asked a request to come into the Leinster under 20s competition because the Munster under 20s competition was 5 or 6 games were cancelled and they felt as though they couldn't give them a game. So maybe that might be somewhere where they would actually focus their energy on, you know. So it's the pathway leading up. But Munster's solution to this is we're just going to throw money at another player to come in, and that's fine. But I think they might. I think if the focus was a bit lower down, I think they probably get more benefit from it. I watched Craig Casey, who's a fantastic guy, a fantastic player, and we had him at the Irish 18s. He was captain for our Irish 18s team a few years back. He's an incredible competitor. He got 3 minutes at the weekend.
Yeah.
And you're going, hold on a minute. Craig's not a little boy. Craig is a capped full Irish international. That's what he is. How benefit would have been he had got if he had played against DuPont? Now, I'm not saying start him, but I'm saying that, like, give him the opportunities. And I think when you look at the Will Connors, I think is a good example. I think Dan Sheen is one that's going to come true as well. Ryan Baird is another one. And even with Furlong, and go all the way back, they were drip fed into the team. And they got their minutes being drip fed in, and they got their minutes with working with well-established professionals to learn to be professionals. Now, they've got Munster have Peter Manny, who's being a captain of a Lions test team. So that's the experience he has on it. Surely he's there to help bring Coombs through and bring Witcherly through and bring these guys through. You don't need a foreign South African to come in and do that job for him. You know, we already have Snyman is there. If you go through the foreign players that they had in the past. Jim Williams, what did Jim Williams do? Well, he brought the likes of Wally and Quinlan and all these guys through. If you look at Johnny Langford, so Langford came in and brought O'Connell and Dunica, which ended up being legends of the club. And I think that's where the overseas player is a massive benefit. I think without Felipe arriving in Leinster in 2003 or 2004, I don't think you would have had Johnny Sexton being World Player of the Year because he learns from that. You know, Rocky Elson is a great example. He brought Sean O'Brien through, and then Sean can then bring the other guys through. And what you're seeing is you see this kind of boot room old way of doing things, and they're able to teach them to be professional. Like Will Connors is holding tackle bags and making tackles with Sean O'Brien in the start 15, and that's who he's learning from. He's seeing, well, this is what Sean does, this is what I'm going to do. And it's, I think that's how you use your overseas player and your foreign player. But and that's, I'm kind of a bit shocked they've gone with the, as everyone probably is, gone with an overseas player to fix the their back row situation or back row second row, whatever they're going to do. I'm kind of thinking of O'Hearn. I only watched O'Hearn play in the 20s last year. Jeez, he was an absolute standout.
Yeah,
he was an incredible player, and he's won. Like, okay, I don't know the background behind it. I don't know whether he could be injury prone. He could be anything. But I kind of go, Jesus, he there's someone that's going to rival James Ryan. There's someone that's going to rival Burge. There's these guys are ready to go, and I'm going, how is he going to get minutes now on the pitch? You know, yeah. You know, Snyman is essentially a new signing because he's only played about 12 minutes of rugby.
I know it's a really interesting one because I had the same thoughts, because when it got announced, my first reaction was, why not give the opportunity to some of the younger players coming through? Because it's not like you don't have, like you mentioned, those experienced players that you've brought in from overseas. Like, you've seen already, they have Snyman, they have Day and Day as well, who have both been in World Cup finals. And like, at the end of the day, is like, the one thing I took from Leinster kind of growing up is you saw Rocky Elson come in, you saw the likes of Issa Nafewa come in, but it wasn't so much that you're trying to bring in foreign players all the time. You're bringing it in so that when a young player in that position comes up, is that one is because it does take a lot to learn how to be a professional rugby player, because you know yourself is the difference between the under 20s and then having to push up to actually be professional. I think we've seen some of the benefits this season. I think one of the standout performers has probably been Scott Penny for Leinster. That
yeah.
You look at him 2 years ago and he wouldn't have been close to the level he's at. And at the point now where you're seeing some fans being like, when is he going to get his chance in a really big game for Leinster? And yeah. Because you've seen it, but we've seen other players kind of come through. And the one name that I think of in terms of not foreign player, but Jamie Heath, that bringing through a lot of players, you see the likes of now, you mentioned kind of Will Connors, Caelan Doris as well. We're now seeing the likes of Scott Penny, and that kind of back row is such a strength for Leinster. But you look at the front row as well, where you have the likes of Furlong, Porter, Keane Healy, and now we're talking about some of these next kind of players coming through. I guess the one question I do have, because I always wondered this, is I know there's the normal progression from like schools rugby, that they go from there to kind of the academy system in Leinster. Is there a structure in place for, you know, the players that may play more club rugby than schools rugby, for is there a place where they go into if someone excels at kind of a club rugby scene rather than true schools? Let's say they go to kind of a school that's predominantly JA, for example, yeah. but they like to play rugby and they play for a club.
There's a young kid, and he's not the only one, called Tim Corkery, who went to St Kieran's, which is in Kilkenny, which is where half the Kilkenny hurling team goes. So,
yeah.
so he's pretty much an outlier. What tends to happen is there's two under 18 teams, so one is clubs and one is schools. Yeah. And then they actually amalgamate at 19.
Okay.
So you'd have a pool of maybe 40 players, and then they pick actually a pool of maybe 45 from the two pools below. And it's very much, I know Simon Broughton has been the head coach there for a number of years. He is incredible at bringing them together. And it's a huge strength of his to be able to bring people from different dynamics and different environments and different cultures, whether they be the Blackrock Michaels, whether it be someone from St. Kieran's or Kilkenny Rugby Club or Navan Rugby Club. And Simon does an incredible job at doing that, at bringing them through. Then what happens is they actually go into a sub-academy. So the select few which is great, because there's no timeline on the sub-academy. They could be there for 2 years. They could be there for a year. So the likes of Jamie Osborne, you can see now, is a sub-academy player. He's not an academy player. So he's now played on the senior team. And it helps with their development. And it helps with if there's any part of their game that's probably missing or not as up to speed, or the opportunity. the opportunity where they might have a low training age. They might only have a training age in the gym of 1 or 2 years, and they need that extra 2 years in the gym or 2 years of skills or whatever to bring them up. But they have a level of potential, and they have Leinster have a talent ID coach as well, who's Trevor, and he tries to spot the talent within and find, well, what environment have they been in, and how does is the potential to grow? What is that potential to grow? So it's not an exact science. There's a lot of coaching eye involved. There's data collection involved. There's scanning around clubs and schools to see what that player is and who they are. So it's not a case of the Michaels and Blackrock and the Clongos player just go straight in and this is where the production line goes. No, it's vast. It's the talent ID that those guys do is incredible, and as well as the coach development officers. I think the other thing we got to probably say is the people that are working at that level in Leinster, right, that are behind the scenes, they're not the Leo Cullens or the Stuart Lancasters, are the likes of Trevor. Trevor's played for the senior team for years and years. He's played in the Heineken Cup. Simon Broughton has played for the senior team. Declan O'Brien is in charge of coach education. He's played for the senior team. The domestic games manager is Philip Lawler, who's a former Irish number 8, and he's played for Leinster. So the level below, I think it would blow people away, the level of expertise that is below the senior team, shall I say. So that part that operates in between. Dennis Leamy is in that group. Dennis Leamy is an elite player development officer. He's a Grand Slam winning winning player. He's from Munster. He's come from Munster. Noel Mack, who's coaching was coaching the Irish under 20s, has coached in the domestic game for, I'd say Mac has coached for about 15 years, where he started in Clongos under 13s and then moved on and then coached the 18s Leinster, 19s Leinster, 18s Irish. So the level of expertise out there is of rugby knowledge, coaching knowledge is huge. So the kids that's coming through, that's their first step into Leinster. You know, Andy Skeen is the head coach of the 18s, and Andy's director of rugby of St. Michael's, who are producing so many different players. You know, so the knowledge in the group is like, it's vast. Like, I'm not too sure there's too many clubs that can do that. You know, I think I went down to Toulouse with one of the development officers, and we looked at their academy was coached by Clement Protrenot, who was obviously the French fullback. And you thought, look at this. And then you kind of go back to ours and go, well, hold on. We got Dennis Leamy. We got Trevor Hogan. We have Simon Brown. We have our own. So I actually think that's a huge part of what Leinster do, you know, and it's something that we probably need to be a bit more proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting ones I find is, I guess these 2 years is going to be an interesting one for, let's say, the current kind of fifth and sixth years, because we have seen kind of the senior cup be halted. And do you think that's going to make it a little bit more difficult, let's say, for when these guys do leave and they don't get to play in the school's rugby, and instead, let's say, they go into college and they play for their clubs? Do you think, would that be in terms of a similar pathway of what we were just talking about, that you have kind of the club team and also the schools team, especially now because some of these players might be a little bit older, because we saw last year they had to cancel the tournament halfway through. This year we're not 100% sure if we'll get it. And then you may have players that are currently in fifth year that next year they may not be within schools rugby because they could have missed so much in their education as well. Do you think that makes the job for some of those kind of ID managers very difficult over the next 2 to 3 seasons?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really difficult. And we ain't going to solve the problem with what we did in the past. So the problem that we have, or the solution to this problem, is going to have to be some really far out thinking. And we've Andy and myself have already had the chats about it, of how we would select an 18 squad for if we were to run a summer program in August. How do we go about that? And there's been a few curveballs. It would be fine for us if the school's cup did go ahead at any stage. Again, I as I said to you, there's been talk of it, but And I know the schools are, some schools are very active in terms of they wanted to go ahead. I think it'd be fantastic because it would just get kids playing.
Yeah.
In terms of the talent pool, we'll probably be going on what they did when they were JCT players, so when they were under 15 players, to see. So that's going to be huge for us to try and pick them. However, because Leinster run an 18s and 19s and a 20 side, that if a player is in fifth year and he goes into sixth year and we get rugby back going again, there's other opportunities for them. So they won't, I'm going to say they won't be missed. They won't, like the talent ID process that's in place in Leinster very rarely misses players.
Yeah.
Because it's a small group. My issue probably is maybe kids who, if one sport gets back and the other sport doesn't get back, that they just jump into it. So I know GA at the higher level is back on in the next 2 weeks, which is fantastic to see. But I wouldn't like if their 18s got back and our 18s didn't get back, because ours is perceived as being more contact. So I think that's one for the sports administrators in Irish rugby to try and sort out. But I would just look to see kids back playing the sport and as quickly as possible. But in terms of disrupting the talent ID production line that Leinster have, yeah, it'll be disruptive, but it's not. It hasn't stopped. You know, I know the club sides have actually taken the opportunity where their S&C guys are doing a lot of work with them. Their nutritioners doing a lot of work. So it's a lot of stuff like this of online learning and Zooms and all this, and the kids must be sick of it at this stage.
Yeah.
But that's the window of opportunity that they have. And in fairness to the S&C guys and the rugby staff at that level, they've taken that on board and they've embraced it, and everyone's tried their best. You know,
yeah,
and we'll probably look back at it in 5 or 6 years' time and say, well, why is there no players coming through? That's probably the reason. But I don't think that's going to be the case. I think we'll always be able to find those three or four players every year that will come through the system, and hopefully Andy's job and my job is to try and provide players for the 19s. That's our job, you know, and then the 19th job is to provide people for the sub academy, and the hope, that's the way it kind of, we pass the baton on. You know, and we'd like to think we're not going to miss too many people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, look, we could easily be talking about this for hours. It's something that I've always been interested in for a long time. I know I've even just coaching at kind of the schools level, and even seeing the way kind of Andy does operate as well. You can see kind of how important it is to be able to ID some of these players as they're kind of coming through, and it's always been good, and I've always felt that having that kind of under 18 straight away, kind of that transition from schools rugby to playing in the academy, is a really important step. And it's the reason why I think I asked the question about the difference between kind of the culture in Leinster versus in Munster, that it's important so that there are these kind of stepping stones for each player to actually be able to kind of move on. Because at the end of the day, even if a player is not going to be good enough to play for the Leinster first team, I guess the whole point is that you can set them up so that they may get a professional career somewhere else. Whether it's now we're seeing kind of the advancements in like the league over in America, for example, you're seeing it in Japan as well, where you're seeing a lot of these new kind of teams come up, and you're seeing players from all over kind of move there. Now we've seen a couple of lads from Connacht move over to LA and stuff like that over the last year, but it's one of those that I find really interesting and really happy that you could join me today to talk about this.
You've got to admire as well someone like Leo, because he's drip fed those players in, where there's a very strong relationship with obviously the academy managers and everyone below their academy manager and below that, to find out. And Leo's incredible knowledge of the players within the pathway would actually shock a lot of people. It is incredible. He knows more or less every kid that's coming up through the rank. And what I think is fantastic is he knows when to play them, and he knows how much minutes to give them. So for example, I coach Dan Sheen in school, and I've always been a big fan of Dan, and he's a fantastic person, and and he's a very enjoyable person to coach, a very coachable guy, and he's incredibly talented. I was actually disappointed that he wasn't on the bench for the Pro 14 final.
Yeah.
You go, well, hold on a minute. James Tracy was in front of him, and you go, oh, okay. And then you go, well, and Cronin is also there in front of him, and you go, oh, yeah, well, that's where he's actually at. And but I have to say the management of his minutes has been absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I'd love to see him play against Mascherano or, you know, one of the other hookers. And I think Leinster probably have four hookers that are probably better than what Munster have at the moment. And I just think the management of that is absolutely sensational. To keep four people on board, I'm not going to say keep them happy, because I would imagine three of them will always be unhappy. Yeah. But to keep that going is an incredible thing to do for sports management. It's an incredible thing for a coach to do. And I've said it for years, I don't think Leo gets that credit. But it's wonderful to watch. You know, I don't think Leo would really give the player the 3 minutes that the likes of Craig Casey got.
Yeah.
I think Leo is going to give the player 20 minutes. Why? Because he trusts them. He trusts them in the environment. He trusts in their roles. He trusts the system that they've come through. Look, he's a Leinster man true and true, but he knows what the player is going to give him at that time. And it comes to a stage where you have to trust your players, you know, because... I would be concerned if I was Craig Casey. I would be really concerned, because I'm not getting any game time, or the game time I probably deserve. Should he start? Yeah, there's an argument that he could start, but obviously Conor Murray is a fantastic player as well. But I'm not too sure that's managed as well as it has been in Leinster, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting, because we always hear, especially in the national media, about how there's the succession plan to Johnny Sexton and players aren't getting enough minutes there, whether it's Ross Byrne, Harry Byrne, or you can even kind of throw Kieran Frawley in there. But we don't really hear it as much when it comes to that idea of Craig Casey kind of coming in behind Conor Murray, where there were people that were surprised that he was included into the Irish setup, considering he had played, I think, a total of about 50 or 60 minutes in the Pro 14 at the time. But it kind of showed to his work ethic and people that were there that believed in the talent. But at some point he's going to need to play, and we saw this something similar happen at Leinster, where Joey Carberry had to go to Munster so he could get game time. Is if, let's say, Conor Murray wants to continue playing for the foreseeable future in the next 5, 6, 7 years, then what does Craig Casey need to do to kind of be able to get that game time? And that's a big question that I think
It's a tough one for Craig, because Craig is so passionate about Munster. His dad works for Munster, and he's Munster true and true. He's from Shannon. He played basketball, and he's a fantastic Munster person. And that's something for him. But he's probably going to have that conversation with the head coach and say, listen, I'm now a captain international. I've international minutes behind me here. So it's not as though you're giving it to a young academy kid coming through, because he's not a young academy kid now. He's now a capped international, you know, and those guys there, if you go on the field, are Six Nations, you want to be bloody good. And he's gone on the Six Nations team. That's one of the top Six Nations teams too. So it's not as though he's run out for on the bench of Italy and someone got injured on the warm-up and he was thrown in. He's actually been selected. So I think maybe a bit more trust in what he can do. And by the way, maybe they don't trust him. And then he's into another situation, another awkward conversation.
It's that a problem though? Because look, I think we'll end it on this point, because it's a good one based on kind of Leo Cullen. Because like you said, I don't think he does get enough credit for a lot of the work that is done with Leinster. I know there's a lot of people that do reference kind of Stuart and the job that he's done, which has been phenomenal, but I think they work well together to kind of get the system in place. But do you think that's a problem that we've clearly seen, that Leo's brought players through and he trusts them and that they'll do the job in the system that he wants to play? Do you think that is a problem then, if a coach didn't trust them? Like we've seen the amount of players that have come through Leinster, the fact that you can see that there's kind of data there that shows that the coaching staff and the management staff trust these young players to come in and to do what they would expect them of. But when you don't see that happen at other clubs, and it's one of the reasons why it kind of annoyed me a little bit as an Irish fan, when you do see someone like CJ obviously leaving, and then instead of bringing in or giving that opportunity to some of the younger players, that you do try and fill it with a player from abroad. Like, I know there were rumors of other kind of kind of World Cup winning players possibly coming in, when I understand the player that they brought in now, that maybe that's not the full long term. But if you're bringing in a World Cup winning player, you're expecting them that they're going to be there for the next 6 or 7 years. And it's not really a 1 year thing, unless it's what we're seeing up in Ulster for the next season. But do you think the trust between, I guess, all the different coaching staffs from academy up for these young players is probably the most critical part of their development?
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know whether it's to do with the overseas coach. And what I mean by that is, I think Leo's played in all of those teams. He's come through the same pathway as a majority of the players. The mantra of the academy is homegrown talent. So they're trying to find homegrown talent, and they put a bloody incredible amount of hours to try and find that. And Leo's knowledge of the system is just fantastic. So he knows the kid that's coming through, and he knows what they can do. He brings them up into the training grounds. He puts them on the training. If he feels as though they're not ready, he won't put them on the pitch.
Yeah.
You know, it's very simple. But he, look, I'm only seen as an outsider. I'm not part of an inner circle here or not. But
yeah,
this is all I see. I see an incredible amount of trust in what he, in the system, and because I think it'd be really frustrated if I was an academy staff member. And I see this in Chelsea. I had this conversation with the guy in Chelsea very recently, where, why do you guys put in so much effort when Abramovich just goes and buys a new player?
Yeah.
And I think that's where we are in Munster a bit. Now, I know you can throw at me Coombs and stuff like that. Coombs is a fantastic player, and hopefully he goes on and becomes one of their top players, and just not obviously in an Leinster game. But this is the knowledge of the system has actually forced Leo into this. Also, someone said, well, can Leinster afford to bring in World Cup players? I don't know the finance. Maybe not now, but they could if they wanted to. I'd imagine they brought in a Rocky Elson, they brought in a Felipe over the years, they brought in the Sewa, you know, and those guys cost a bit of money. But they're brought in for the right reason. They've brought in to help young guys. They're brought in because there's a problem. Like, I remember a player from Wasps called Will Green. You know, Leinster struggled with a tight head. They brought him in, and again, he would have helped those young kids to come through. He would have helped that, and even LaRue and people like that. They're there to help. They're there to aid the system. But I think if you're bringing in players just to and knocking one of your own off. Yeah, I'm really struggling. If I was development staff, I'd be pulling my hair out, going, "Well, do you not trust the player that we're developing for you?"
You know, yeah,
I do think Leo definitely trusts what's beneath, and he's incredible knowledge of what's beneath.
Yeah, I think that's something that fans actually prefer, because if you look at it as an Irish fan and a Leinster fan, it's something that you can really be proud of, to see some of these guys that. One, that if you worked with at the schools level. Two, that if you've seen kind of come up and then you're getting to see them come through the Leinster Academy, you get to see them play for Leinster, then to be internationals. I think there's a lot more pride in that than you get the kind of initial hysteria of signing this kind of big name player. Yeah. So it is one of those that I think as a fan I prefer. That I see some of these young players come through, and you have to give their dues to Leinster and the staff that they've put together, that they've really done a superb job in bringing these players through and kind of bringing them in when, as you said, when they're ready to play.
Yeah, and like, even when a player does come through the systems, like like even like someone like Jamie Osborne, straight away the management staff of the youth's 18 or the club's 18 sides, they're sending texts of fantastic to see Jamie. Like there's an incredible amount of pride with the people who are involved, whether it be analysts or S&Cs or coaches or peripheral staff, managers, assistant managers of those teams, where we kind of like, yes, we were part of that. You know what?
Yeah.
And it is a good feel factor about it. Like, I know myself and Andy have coached the schools for what, 3 years. I think we've had two players that have made senior caps, and there's part of it going, isn't that fantastic? Isn't that brilliant? You know, because it you kind of feel as though that all that work that you did 3 years ago, and by the way, we're only claiming 0.5% of it. You know, so the prize that I know someone like Trevor or Simon or Noel or Dennis would have, because they've had them for a lot longer, the pride that they have is fantastic too. And they're very much a bit of a clap on the back. Well done that we've now produced a player at that level. Like I'm quite proud of the fact I coached Dan Sheen since he was 15 years of age. And yeah, I'd like to think that I helped him for that 1% of the time I had him. And then I passed him on to someone else and they brought him on to another level. And I think that's a huge part of rugby development and talent ID. And it's something that I feel, having been involved in Leinster's age grade teams for 15 years, it's something that I've always felt with the people involved.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great talking to you today, Brett. That was, again, like I said, could easily be talking for another 3 hours about some of this stuff, especially when it comes to kind of the development of players, because I think that's the most important thing, especially when you kind of look at the Leinster side, because it's become kind of the main cog in how this kind of, as they say, in the kind of how the machine works. Where can people find some? I know you do a lot of analysis on Twitter, so where can people find?
Yeah, I throw it a bit on Twitter, which is for which is mainly for coach education. For years I was looking at people put stuff up and I was going, nah. And I've mates going, you should start a podcast, you should start a website, you should start this. And then I said, look, I'm actually busy, so I just do the random Six Nations. I tend to just do Six Nations and then I'd probably disappear now that Six Nations are gone, though I am very excited about the Heineken Cup this year for some reason. Maybe it's because the standard of the seven games is so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Just so everybody knows, just to make sure that you subscribe to the podcast on, look, we're everywhere. We're on YouTube, Spotify, Google Podcasts. We have all this linked up onto Twitter as well. So we have pretty much a live stream pretty much every single week. We had two today, which was great for a bank holiday. But it's been really good talking to you, and we'll definitely have you on again.
Great, Kieran. Thanks. Great to meet you.
All right. You too.
Thanks.